I would think it would be scary enough to be on trial for a crime you didn't commit, say, here in the United States. But take that thought in a different direction. Could you imagine being tried for a crime that you did not commit on foreign soil? And how about in a country that was even hostile to the United States or to Americans? I mean, can you imagine being tried in Russia, for instance? Could you imagine being tried in a place like Syria? Could you imagine being tried in North Korea? Now, some of you might remember, we've seen some of these things happen. For instance, American missionary Kenneth Bae, who was arrested by North Korean authorities back in 2012, Bae was visiting North Korea for the 15th time in 2 years because he was a guide for his own North Korean tour company. Bae's arrest came after he entered the country with an external hard drive filled with files and photos documenting his missionary work. He has since said, yeah, that probably was not the best idea of things to take. It just was something that he, at the time, really wasn't thinking about. Authorities seized on references to Operation Jericho, a prayer mobilization plan that invoked military metaphors to justify their charges of insurrection, meaning going against a governing authority. He was arrested in December 2012 and tried and sentenced in April of 2013. Thankfully, he was released in November 2014 after intense American lobbying. At the time, Bae was the longest serving U.S. prisoner in North Korean history. Some of you also might remember even more recently, University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier, who was arrested in January 2016 for allegedly trying to remove a piece of North Korean propaganda from a wall in a hotel. In any case, the Korean Central News Agency said that he was accused of, quote, perpetrating a hostile act against the DPRK, intending to bring down the foundation of its single-minded unity with the tacit connivance of the U.S. government and under its manipulation. He was seemingly forced to make a public confession saying, please, people in the government of the DPR Korea, I beg that you see how I was used and manipulated, he said, his voice breaking into sobs. I have made the single worst decision of my life, but I am only human. I beg that you find it in your hearts to allow me to return home to my family. He also praised North Korea's humanitarian treatment of severe criminals like himself. And in the course of this 35-minute address, described Pyongyang as an Eastern Jerusalem. 2.5 weeks later, following a trial that lasted 1 hour, Warmbier was sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. Since then, he has been held at an undisclosed location. You can only imagine what was going on in both men's heads as they went before the North Korean Supreme Court. One being obviously not guilty, one we're not quite sure of, but obviously the charges that they gave him seem on the extreme side. Well, today we're going to see someone else tried by a hostile government for a crime they did not commit. So with that, go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Luke 23. Luke 23. So this morning, we're going to be looking at verses 2 all the way to 25. And yes, we're biting off a little bit more than we normally do. And therefore, we might not be going, say, quite as deep as we often do. It doesn't mean that there's not more than appropriate application. There certainly is. But I wanted to keep the three phases of Jesus' Roman part of the trial intact. Last week, we looked at the three phases of his Jewish trial. This week, it's the three phases of his Roman trial. I didn't want to break it up and go about it that way. I want you to experience the same theme as last week, which is the fact that all Jesus goes through and endures during these three phases of this trial, as he did with the three phases of the last trial, he does it for who? You. Me. He does it for us. Let's start with the first phase. Jesus before Pontius Pilate, just to get us up to speed. First phase of Jesus before Pontius Pilate. But in order to get into the right context there of that, let's go back to that last phase, the third phase of Jesus's trial with the Jews, with the Jewish authorities, which was the official meeting of the Sanhedrin back at the temple. So actually, I'm just going to jump back to 22 verse 66. When it was day, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber, saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am." Then they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." And the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. So friends, this is the moment they've been waiting for, really. The Sanhedrin feels like they've got enough goods on Christ. They're all in agreement that he's guilty. He's deserving of death. Now they can bring him before Pilate. This is what we've been waiting for. Pontius Pilate, the governor of the region. And again, the reason is because the Jews, though they had a death penalty, they weren't allowed by the Romans to put anyone to death. They had to do it through Rome. So ultimately, once they decided his fate, then it would have to go to Rome to actually carry it out. Let's ask this question. Who's this man, Pontius Pilate? It's funny, as I went back through all my notes of Luke, I even went back through all of my... That's what's cool about a computer. You know, you can search things for all the files in my last 10 years here, just to see what we had spoken about or talked about regarding Pilate. And little bits and pieces here and there, but nothing too extensive. And while we're at it, in terms of trying to understand a little bit of who Pilate was, in this passage today, part of the second phase of the trial is when he goes to Herod. So we'll include Herod in this brief discussion about who's Pilate, who is Herod, so we have some context when we see them mentioned in the Scripture. Now, back in 63 BC, as Rome ruled its empire with a Caesar on the throne, they decided to rule Judea by placing a king over her, more of a localized kind of a form of government. Rome wisely realized it would be better to appoint indigenous leaders, leaders from that region, from those people groups, but those who would likely be able to control the people and do it probably better than the Romans. The Romans would just go in and do it by force, but they have some better chances of not having to just mass slaughter people, you know, if they did it with the indigenous folks. However, at the same time, this ruler must absolutely be loyal to his Roman masters. This was found in what are known as the Herods of Idumea. Okay? Being of Idumean descent means they could trace their lineage back to Jacob's apostate brother Esau. And what the Romans weren't figuring into the equation was that the Jews would now be ruled by their despised next-door neighbors, as the Idumeans resided south of Judah. And because of this, they often had skirmishes with each other until a fellow named Judas Maccabeus, a Jewish man, captured Hebron in Idumean territory, followed by then John Hyrcanus, thus both of them compelling the Idumeans to become Jews and forcibly submit to circumcision. Now, the Herod, when Christ was born, was Herod Antipater, also known as Herod the Great. He had been declared king of the Jews by Caesar Augustus and Antony back in 40 BC. There was only one little problem. As we said, he was Idumean, not distinctly Jewish. So you can imagine how well that sat with the Jews, right? Not very well. So he, in hopes of appeasing the Jews, he married a Jew named Mariamne, a Jewish heiress of the house of Hasmonean, in hopes of making himself just a little more palatable, a little more acceptable to the Jews as their king. Well, he was then followed by his son, Herod Antipas, who was the ruler of Galilee and Perea, the territories in which Jesus and John the Baptist carried out most of their ministries. It was this Herod Antipas, who beheaded John the Baptist, and who we will see in a few minutes participates in the second phase of Christ's Roman trial. All right, so getting back to Pilate, just a few more things about him and his position as governor, also known as prefect, also known as procurator of Judea. Now, a procurator was a financial officer of Rome who supervised and collected taxes in an assigned province. In Judea and other lesser provinces of the Roman Empire, the procurator acted at times as the governor of that region. He not only managed financial affairs, but he also exercised judicial, military authority. He was primarily responsible for keeping peace in his jurisdiction. So this was Pontius Pilate's role, as it was for those after him. We see, like in the book of Acts, you might remember Felix and Festus. They were in that same position as Pontius Pilate. He was appointed by Roman Caesar Tiberius to be the fifth governor of Judea, serving from AD 26 to 36, so 10 years. He was known to be proud, arrogant, cynical, insensitive to the Jews, and frankly brutal, as well as weak and even vacillating. Outside of his role in the crucifixion of Jesus, the Gospels have very little about him, with the exception of back in Luke 13 and verse 1, we had this text. Now on the same occasion, there were some present who reported to Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And if you remember, we learned this back in 2015, that when we covered this passage, Pilate had slaughtered a number of Galileans. Most likely it was a group of Jews known as the Zealots, who had gathered to offer God their sacrifices. Now, the Zealots, you may remember, as we've talked about them a little bit, were a group of very militant, anti-Roman revolutionaries, equally religious and political in their motivation. One of Jesus' 12 disciples, Simon, was a Zealot. In any case, it seems Pilate had some kind of run-in with some of these Zealots from Galilee. They had been there offering sacrifices. And he wanted to kind of show them who's the boss, you know? And so he first kills them all, and then he takes their blood, and to add insult to injury, he mixes their blood with the blood of their sacrifices that were given to God. So you can start to see what kind of a guy this is. The other place where we get some good we get some good info on Pilate are through some extra-biblical sources. Some of the early historians like Josephus or Roman historian Tacitus and Philo. There are several other stories that convey his brutality, but here is one that ultimately led to his dismissal as governor. Josephus records the story of Pilate's dismissal. In AD 36, a Samaritan false prophet pretending to be the Taheb or Samaritan Messiah promised to show his followers some sacred vessels hidden by Moses on Mount Gerizim. Pilate sent a heavily armed contingent of footmen and cavalry who intercepted the pilgrims and slaughtered most of them. The Samaritans complained to Vitellius, the prefect of Syria, whereupon Pilate was ordered to report to the emperor of Rome, Tiberius. Another prefect, Marcellus, was then sent by Rome as Pilate's replacement. Tiberius knew he wouldn't be going back. The history of Pilate after his dismissal in AD 36 is unknown. Eusebius reports that Pilate ultimately committed suicide during the reign of the emperor Caligula, somewhere between 37 AD and 41 AD. So those are the two men that we will be dealing with primarily here this morning. Now, once again, once the Jews finished their trial of Jesus, they found him guilty. They found him deserving of death. 23 verse 1, then the whole body of them, that's the Sanhedrin, got up and brought him before Pilate. And again, it was because they couldn't put anyone to death. The Romans had to do that. And they're going to have to appeal to Rome, which meant the one in charge in their area, which was Pontius Pilate. So they needed to go talk to Pilate. They brought Jesus to Pilate's palace, which is called the Praetorium. Look now at 23, starting in verse 2. And they, that would be the Jewish Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, began to accuse him, Jesus, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So Pilate asked him, saying, Are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him and said, It is as you say. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. But they kept on insisting, saying, He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee even as far as this place. And when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also in Jerusalem at that time. All right, so we're going to stop there for a moment. Just consider a few things, as this is that first phase of Jesus' trial by the Romans. And what we saw is this. The Jews lay out, you notice, three charges against Jesus. And what's interesting is only the last one is the one that they decided back at Caiaphas's house and then in that Sanhedrin meeting. The other two, seemingly they just decided to add in along the way, maybe for good measure. Let's see if they're true. The first one was that he misleads the nation. He's been misleading the Jewish nation. It's kind of a general charge, isn't it? In the sense of Jesus saying that he was sent from God to show the Jewish nation God's way. It's a broad accusation as it's a matter of perception and dispute. Secondly, the next charge was that he was forbidding the Jews to pay taxes to Caesar. And of course, this is just patently false, as Jesus specifically endorsed paying taxes to Caesar. You might remember in Luke 20:25, where the scribes and the Pharisees are trying to trip Jesus up on a question about paying taxes. And what did he say to them? Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, meaning pay your taxes to Caesar, right? And render to God the things that are God's. So this charge was just a flat-out lie designed to get Pilate, I think they were hoping, kind of riled up and maybe get him invested in the trial so that he would agree with them that Jesus was guilty and deserved to die. Thirdly, they said that he claimed he himself to be Christ, a king. And this is, of course, true, with Jesus himself saying as much. But from the Jews' perspective, it was the worst crime of the three. And did you catch the word that they added? And you think probably for the benefit of Pilate, they said that Jesus was declaring himself Christ, which means Messiah or anointed one. But then they also added King. It's like, just in case you aren't getting this, Pilate, he's making himself out to be our king by his own authority, not by Rome's authority, not by our authority. He didn't ask for our permission. He certainly didn't ask for Rome's permission. He certainly didn't ask for your permission, did he, Pilate? And I think it's also probable that part of their motive is that they are presenting Jesus as some kind of competition against Pilate. Pilate, he may be coming after, you know, your job. Secondly, we want to look at this. In verse 3, Pilate doesn't even bother with the first two charges, but he goes right to the third one, asking Jesus if this is true about him being the king of the Jews. Wondering, you know, okay, is this guy some kind of zealot? Is he some kind of revolutionary? And Jesus' response is simply an affirmation that he is king of the Jews. Now, what happens next in verse 3 is very interesting, because Pilate makes a decision, and the decision is our next point, that Jesus is not a threat and therefore is found innocent. Uh-oh, Jews aren't going to get what they want. So now they have to start making more of a case to Pilate, saying that, you know, well, he stirred up all the people and he's doing this over a significant amount of geographic area from Judea, Galilee, all the way down to Jerusalem. Our fourth point, Pilate sees a way out, though. He sees a way out. At this point, it would seem that Pilate just wants to be, you know, basically done with, I think he kind of viewed them as pesky Jews who are trying to put to death an innocent man simply because they just don't like him. And when they mention that he's from Galilee, Pilate's ears, his radar kind of goes, oh, did you say Galilee? And so he asked Jesus for confirmation, which Jesus must have gave him, because then Pilate's like, oh, yes, Yes, I can pass this off to my old buddy Herod. Send him over to Herod, who just happens to be in Jerusalem at the time. What luck! In Pilate's mind, I think he's thinking, hey, this is over and done with. I'll let Herod have this headache. And away Jesus goes to Herod. Now, please turn in your Bibles to John. You can keep Luke 23, Mark, but go to John 18. We visited John 18 a couple of times, and we need to go there again. John 18, starting in verse 33. Because before we move on to the second phase, this is one of those places where we have to at least just read what John has to say about this first meeting between Jesus and Pilate, because John does give us some more additional details, though we're not going to be going deep into the details. But I do want you to see that some other things were said with Pilate before he got moved off to Herod. This is John 18, starting in verse 33. Therefore, Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Let me interject here, right? He's speaking of his spiritual heavenly kingdom, of course. Verse 37, therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And then watch, Pilate asked him this age-old question. Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him." Now, we're going to move back into the second phase of Jesus' Roman trial. You can turn back to Luke 23. Now, Herod was not a Roman per se, but he was there to do Rome's bidding, and he was there to keep the Jews in line. And now Pilate is referring this matter to Herod. Look at 23, verse 8. Now, Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at some length, but he, Jesus, answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. And Herod with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Let's just make a few remarks here regarding this second phase. It's interesting, isn't it? Herod is actually welcoming the participation in Jesus' trial, because he's heard a lot about Jesus. He knows how famous Jesus is, and really, what is he hoping to see? He wants to see a miracle or two, huh? He wants to see some of these cool signs. I was thinking, yeah, you know, over the years, I've always enjoyed meeting, you know, say, famous people when you've had an opportunity, and maybe you have too, or even getting a picture with somebody or an autograph or what have you. And even some famous people like to meet other famous people. And kind of, you know, hooking back to our initial picture story at the beginning, there was a strange situation of this when then you had bizarro, kind of weird, strange basketball star Dennis Rodman, who was invited to hang out with dictator Kim Jong-un of North Korea, which you just think that's kind of strange, huh? It's the famous inviting the famous, but the weird psycho famous inviting the weird famous, whatever. In fact, in the bizarre twist in this was the fact that Dennis Rodman actually went to bat for the release of missionary Kenneth Bay. And Kenneth Bay, after being released, gave a lot of credit to Rodman to kind of getting the ball rolling for his release. But in any case, you got this famous guy, Herod, looking forward to meeting this other famous guy, Jesus. He wanted to meet Jesus, see a miracle or two, which I think, okay, so that really kind of shows how insensitive and a little, maybe, you know, wacko Herod is. Because He's thinking maybe, you know, like this is going to be cool. And Jesus is going to come in and I'll ask him to do some tricks, some miracles, and he'll do some cool things and put on a show for me and my guests. But Herod's the one who imprisoned Jesus' cousin and friend, John the Baptist. He's also the one that cut off John the Baptist's head. And you think, now he's thinking Jesus might give him some kind of show with the miracles and stuff. You think, man, the guy is just out to lunch. And what happens is that he asks Jesus a whole bunch of questions. And Jesus just remains silent. And the Jews are just, man, blasting him, angry accusations. Jesus deserves death. He deserves death. Which Herod basically understands, right? He knows what they're getting at and why they don't like him, because he's kind of closer to being a Jew than, say, the Romans are or Pilate is. But all this that takes place just totally frustrates Herod. And the fact that Jesus won't respond to anything he says. And since he doesn't have the authority to kill Jesus, what else is he going to do with him? Send him back to Pilate. Send him back to Pilate. But before he goes, in an effort to appease the Jews and humiliate Jesus for not speaking to him, Herod takes a gorgeous robe, I'm sure it's probably one of his own, puts it on Jesus, and then he and the soldiers treat Jesus with contempt and mocking. Oh, what does that involve? Well, remember this. Jesus has already been mocked and beaten already, and no doubt is showing the effects of that, whether that be a swollen eye, a swollen cheek, bloody nose, cuts. We imagine he's starting to get a little bloody. And so the contempt and mocking that Herod and the soldiers are now participating in undoubtedly involves further violence against Jesus. And back to Pilate he goes. Now verse 12 is another interesting verse. Look at what it says. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day. For before they had been enemies with each other. You think, why? Why enemies? Well, from Herod's perspective, remember that he was a king, but with really only superfluous power. He was kind of like many of our modern day monarchs, like, say, you know, the Queen of England, who are really figureheads, but have no real authority in terms of government. Herod, while called a king, was very much a puppet of Rome and always had Rome to answer to. And Rome always trumped his authority and power. And the one representing Rome in this region was, of course, Pilate. So, no, Herod wouldn't have had any great deep lovey-dovey feelings for Pilate. Now, from Pilate's perspective, there were some things that backfired on him that probably left him with a very bad taste in his mouth where Herod is concerned. For instance, there was an occasion where Pilate required shields to be hung in Herod's palace, inscribed with the names of the person dedicating the shield and the one honored by it. It'd be like somebody came to your place of work or your office or your house or whatever and said, no, you're going to put these things up there. You are going to do this. That has nothing to do with you. So the Jews were so upset that they sent a protest to Caesar Tiberius, who angrily told Pilate to place the shields in a pagan temple at Caesarea, where they more properly belonged. Tiberius, unlike Pilate initially, was a little more sensitive to unduly upsetting the Jews or any of his provinces. He wanted to keep the peace a little bit more than Pilate did. Pilate's trying to flex his muscles and act like a big guy. Basically, you see no love lost between the two of them. Yet on this day, something changed. Something changed, and they now had something in common. They had in common this man, Jesus, who was upsetting things, and maybe they could get on the same page in dealing with the situation. This would be the thing that would maybe help to smooth over some of that rocky relationship between the two. This brings us to our third and last phase of Jesus' Roman trial. Back to Pilate. Look at verse 13. So Pilate summoned the chief priests and the rulers and the people, and he said to them, "You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. And behold, having examined him before you, I have found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor has Herod, for he sent him back to us. And behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him." Therefore, I will punish him and release him. The verdict's in. Right? I mean, by both Pilate and Herod, the verdict's in. Which Pilate lays out before all the people, including the Sanhedrin. But now also including the public at large, because everybody's kind of caught on to what's happening, and I'm sure it's daytime now, and a bigger crowd is formed. Herod reiterates the charge that this man, Jesus, in claiming to be a king and inciting rebellion amongst the people, is not guilty. At least he's not guilty of anything deserving of death, which is all the Jews wanted. In fact, over in Mark, Mark tells us that Pilate knew they were bringing Jesus before him because of their envy. So he knew that was going on. In any case, as a concession to the Jews, Pilate decides, I'll have him punished. Most likely the punishment would have been whipping, which was a step down from scourging. We'll talk about that in a sec. However, the whipping that was done by the Romans was not a prescribed amount of strokes, but rather it continued until blood was drawn and the flesh tore open. The Jews, the most they would administer to each other was 39, right? They always did 39, not 40. 40 is what they could legally do, but they held back at 39 in case they made a mistake. And they might have given out one too many. That way they wouldn't go over and have God's consequences. Now look at verse 17. Now he, that's Pilate, was obliged to release to them at the feast one prisoner. Kind of like a, you know, presidential pardon, right? Verse 18, but they cried out all together saying, away with this man and release for us Barabbas! You go, who's Barabbas? Well, verse 19 tells us. Verse 19, he was one who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection made in the city and for murder. In other words, friends, the Jews would rather have Barabbas, this known criminal and even murderer, released than Jesus, who has committed no crime. Look at verse 20. Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again. Now, just pause there for a moment, because before we get there, let's just ask the question, why did Pilate want to release Jesus? Why did he want to release Jesus? Yes, because he didn't find any real guilt in him, or a threat to Rome, but there's another reason that you might remember. This is over in Matthew 27:19. Don't turn there, it's just one verse. And this happened at just about the same time when Pilate's talking to Jesus and talking to the Jews. Matthew 27:19 reports that while he, again that's Pilate, was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him a message saying, have nothing to do with that righteous man. For last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. So, you have this situation, Pilate's wife, and of course he, I think, is taking his wife's words to heart. Who knows where this dream kind of came from? But on top of everything, Pilate's now maybe a little more nervous about putting this righteous man to death because of this dream his wife had. The Romans often considered dreams to be omens. Did God give her this dream? Hard to say. God wasn't looking for things to stop at this point in terms of his son being crucified. This was meaning God's preordained plan for his son, that his son should die. Maybe it was to help Pilate's wife not be culpable. Who knows? And frankly, the scripture just doesn't say. What it does say is that Pilate tried to address the crowd again, then promoting Jesus' release. Verse 21, but they kept on calling out, saying, crucify him! Crucify him! And he said to them the third time, why? What evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. Therefore, I will punish him and release him. But they were insistent with loud voices, asking that he be crucified, and their voices began to prevail. At this point, Pilate's faced with this beyond angry mob. If he lost control, not only might he be in danger, but more than likely, it certainly wouldn't be pleasing to any of his superiors. It's not going to look good on his resume if a riot breaks out on his watch. And it seems like he can't control the people in his charge, especially a bunch of Jews. So, look at verse 24. Pilate pronounced sentence that their demand be granted. And he released the man they were asking for who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder. But he delivered Jesus to their will. You might remember in Matthew chapter 27, verses 24 to 26, Matthew writes, "When Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water, he washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, 'I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves.' And all the people said, 'His blood shall be on us and on our children.' And then he released Barabbas for them. But after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified." So because the sentence was changing to punishment release to death, he wouldn't just have Jesus whipped, but he would have him scourged. And we've talked about scourging before, so we won't go into great detail other than to say it was much worse. It was when they took something that had leather straps on the end, and then tied into the leather straps would be anything like pieces of bone, pieces of glass, what have you, things. I don't know. Gosh, did they have glass? Oh. I might have misspoke there. I think you get the idea of things that could dig into somebody's skin, and it was designed to not just whip, to gash and actually pull the skin off of the body and actually then get into the tendons and muscles below the skin. That was the point of scourging. It was beyond just about anything I think we could imagine. So friends, once again, we are witness to, I reiterate this from last week, the historicity of Jesus. The historicity of Christ going to the cross, which frankly many people doubt. This time, it's not just the Jews, the Jewish leaders that we get this history from, but now we see it from being the Romans being included, Pilate, and then of course Herod, who are now part of the historical narrative, which further corroborates the truth of Jesus going to the cross. And this again shows us that Christianity is not just some mythical woohoo out there. It is based on faith, yes, but it is based on historically grounded faith. Don't let anyone ever tell you otherwise. Excuse me. It's coming not just from the Jews or even a Jewish historian like Josephus, but from the Roman historians as well. Secondly, again, we are witnessing the sovereignty of God, are we not? We are witnessing the sovereignty of God in getting Jesus to the cross. The Romans, and especially Pilate, you think, well, yeah, they should have the last word. Pilate being the guy that he was and the Romans being who they were, they should have the last word about what happens to Jesus. Pilate's word should be law. Even Herod should not have needed to say, pass the buck. But notice that they both caved, and Jesus, his move to the cross continues. That's the sovereignty of God. That's God being in control of the situation. The circle of responsibility for Jesus' death is also growing. It's widening, isn't it? Last week we saw the responsibility of the Jews. Now we see the responsibility as well of the Romans. Last week also we saw the different ways that people view Jesus. We'll look at a couple of those now. One, somebody like Herod. Herod doesn't find any real guilt in Jesus, but he does mock Jesus and he treats him with contempt. Secondly, we have Pilate. Pilate seems to be maybe a bit more civil at first. He finds no guilt in Jesus and he's happy to release him, but he caves under pressure. And oftentimes, friends, when people are hostile to Christ and they're hostile to His gospel, they're failing to understand Him. Right? And if they do start to get maybe a little bit even of what He's about, they just quickly reject Him out of hand. Nope, don't want that Jesus stuff. Get that Jesus stuff away from me. But what we see from Pilate and Herod is more along the lines of indifference. They try to hold a neutral position, but guess what? Neutral never works. Just ask the Boy Scouts of America. Pilate and Herod don't believe Him to be guilty, but they don't stand up for what's right either, and therefore they should be seen as the cowards that they are. And friends, you're going to meet all kinds of people out there in the world who will reject Jesus for one reason or another. Some just flat out hate Him. Others disinterested. Some are seemingly neutral or indifferent, but make no mistake, all of these are guilty of rejecting Him. One as much as the other. Yet who knows when one of those haters of Christ will turn into a lover of Christ. It happens, doesn't it? It happened with Paul. It happened with Paul. Great, great example. Your job, my job, is to be faithful to share Christ, to share the crucifixion of Christ, to share the resurrection of Christ, to share of His great, great love toward wayward sinners. The love that you've experienced from Christ. Now, it's our job to show others that they can have that same forgiveness of sins, the same love of Christ, if they would repent of their sin, if they would believe that Jesus died for their sin, that Jesus went into the grave for 3 days before He rose victoriously out of that tomb and conquered death and conquered hell and conquered Satan and went to sit at the right hand of the Father to be our intercessor, our mediator. He gives us the Holy Spirit then to live inside of us to help guide and direct us through this crazy life, to help us deal with our sin, to help us to become more like be made more in the image of Christ until we would physically die have our soul go to be with Christ for all eternity until we're resurrected as well, huh? To live for all eternity with Christ. That's the gospel that you need to believe in. That's the gospel that you need to share. Lastly, we again see that Jesus just never wavers. Never, ever wavers. I mean, His nerve, His resolve is strong. And with each phase of the trial, things obviously are getting worse for Him and worse for Him. And He is now closer than He's ever been to His execution. And yet, He never falters. He never gets off the path. He never goes wayward. And again, we ask the question, how is it that He could go through all of this? Because of His deep and abiding love for you.